Welcome to The Artistic Foodies, the show that explores life through the lens of art and food. I'm Abbas Muhammad.
And I'm Irfan Raidan.
And in this episode, we're talking about halal food and what that means to the Muslim community.
With both Shia and Sunni religious scholars as our guest, we break down the different terms and labels associated with halal, discuss the details of hand versus machine slaughtered for chicken, explore some differences between various schools of thought on the topic, and dig deeper on the philosophy of why we eat halal food.
But wait, there's more. Stay tuned for part two of this episode coming soon, which will explore topics of kosher meats, seafood, halal etiquette, and answers to some frequently asked questions. Our first guest today is Maulana Sheikh Amin, who is a Shia scholar who traveled to the holy city of Qom after high school in 1999 to pursue Islamic studies. He was able to get into one of the top schools at the Hawza Ilmiya in Qom and graduated from the six-year introductory level covering all Islamic disciplines. He then began the four-year intermediate level of fiqh and usul fiqh studies, after which he had the opportunity to participate in advanced fiqh classes. He also holds a master's degree in Semitic religions with a dissertation on the Code of Canon Law in Catholicism through the University of Religions and Denominations of Qom. Sheikh Amin is also a teacher of the Hawza and lectures internationally on various occasions of the Islamic year. In 2017, he moved back to the U.S. and is currently serving the Dallas community. Maulana Amin, can you please tell us what exactly Zabiha Halal is?
Well, now they use this term called Zabiha, or some will just say it with the Z, Zabiha. And so what that means, Zabih in Arabic, or Zabih in Arabic, means to slaughter. And in a fiqhi Islamic legal context, it means to slaughter in accordance with the Islamic protocols that have been set by our Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and for the Shia school of thought, if there are any guidelines in regards to that by the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. All right, so that's what Zabiha now refers to.
So what's interesting to me is a few things. One is the semantics of the Bay Area community might have one definition for Zabiha versus halal, and then the Chicago community believes something different. So you have these geographic microcosms within America, but then also beyond that, which is like the Arab understanding versus the Turkish understanding, versus Southeast Asian understanding of what it is, right? Mm-hmm. So one thing I found really interesting, and I think it's mostly Desis that do this, is there'll be a post about a halal restaurant, and it says halal, and you're in a halal group, but someone in the comment always says, okay, but is this 100% Zabiha? And what they're sort of inferring is it hand slaughtered? Right. But that it only means that for the hand slaughtered crowd. So if the person who posted doesn't care about hand slaughtered, I'll say, yes, it is.
Exactly.
So we're speaking in different languages. And then you got, you know, the marketing terms versus the scholarly terms, or the academic terms, the fiqhi terms, versus then the lay people's terms.
Yeah, this is what I'm trying to say. It's going to just keep getting more and more confusing.
Our next guest, Imam Tahir Anwar, is a Hanafi Sunni scholar who was born in London, England, and has lived in the San Francisco Bay Area since 1983. After completing his religious studies, Imam Tahir has served the Bay Area Muslim community since 2000. And also teaches Islamic law at the renowned Zaytuna College in Berkeley, California. In addition, he is a founding board member of Averroes High School, the Bay Area's first Muslim high school. So let's jump right into this. So first of all, there's a couple of definitions which people always throw around, like halal, zabiha, and tayyib are the three main ones. So what are the main differences between those terms?
You know, in the United States specifically, all of a sudden within the 80s and 90s, there became these sort of two terminologies. Like if it happened to be any meat that you picked up at the supermarket, it was deemed halal. And if you wanted it to be hand slaughtered by a Muslim, then it was deemed dhabiha. Where in reality, in the Muslim world, for generations, the term halal encompassed dhabiha. Fast forward, you know, that sort of the norm sort of became the norm in the United States or in the West sort of became, you know, if it's halal, it's really any meat that's available anywhere minus pork. But if you wanted to follow a higher standard, it is dhabiha. And so these two terms became slightly separated from each other, more specifically in the United States than anywhere else.
It's really, really interesting, I guess, historical context of like the last two generations counting this. This is all very like recent history.
Yeah, it's all very, very recent. And it's more so in the United States than anywhere else.
Now, just to clarify one final point on this one, I've seen some people reference machine slaughtered halal as halal and then hand slaughtered halal as zabiha. Whereas, for example, someone will say, here's this dope halal restaurant that I went to. It's great. Someone will say, but is it zabiha halal? As if that's like a completely other, you know. So is this a technical term? Does this term mean something different to different people?
I guess it's probably more for people the way people understand this more than anything else. Because what that basically means is that you are now putting the machine slaughtered meat in the same category as that of the food of the people of the book, right? Or call it Walmart or Costco meat or Safeway, whatever you want to call it, right? But they're putting that in the same category. And yes, in reality, there are some people who put that in the exact same category. And the people who put that in the same category don't even consider those meats to be halal altogether. They just consider those to be haram altogether.
Imam Dawood Yassin is a Maliki Sunni scholar who is the director of Student Life and Center for Ethical Living and Learning at Zaytuna College in Berkeley, California. His specialties are Arabic, Community Studies, and Ethical Living and Learning. He received his BA in Community Studies from the University of Massachusetts, Boston in 2009, and his MA in Liberal Studies and Globalization Studies from Dartmouth College in 2017. He studied Islam at Abu Nur Institute in Damascus, Syria. Sheikh Yassin's master's thesis titled The Heart of All Contradictions, Muslim Industrial Meat Production and Its Challenge to the Ethical Practice of Islam, examines modern Muslim industrial meat production and ritual slaughter, focusing on its legal, moral, ecological, and ethical considerations.
So dhabiha is actually one of the three ways in which an animal becomes halal. And the other two are called aqir and nahar. Okay? Both of those are in Quran. All three are in Quran. Okay? So dhabaha, the act of ritually cutting the jugular veins, the esophagus, and the trachea. That's what dhabiha means. Aqir is to strike an animal with a projectile. And nahar is to kind of lance an animal with a rod. Now, the interesting thing in what people, and this is how it happens, is that each one of those, dhabah, has a category of animals that it's applicable to. Aqir has a category of animals that it's applicable to, and nahar has a category of animals that it's applicable to, and this is important because you can't use one on the other. Okay, so if you take dhabah, which is the one that everyone knows, it is for domesticated animals that pose no physical harm to the slaughterer. So chicken, goat, sheep, lamb, duck, okay? We're clear on that. The next one, if we took, would be nahar, right? Fasali rabika, wanhar, okay? In the Quran, Allah says, fasali rabika, wanhar. So Allah is telling you that, pray to your Lord, and then slaughter. But in the command of this, he's telling you how to slaughter, which would indicate to you the type of animal that you have to slaughter. So that is for a domesticated animal that can pose, that poses a threat, a physical harm to a human being. Cow, camel, bison, buffalo. Okay? Because you can't just walk up to a camel and slaughter it like you would a chicken. And then you can't apply the manner of nahr to a chicken, right? The manner in which you would slaughter a camel or a cow or something like this, you cannot apply to a chicken. And the last group is for non-domesticated wild animals that you just can't walk up to and slaughter, be they, you know, posing a harm to you or not. And that's where hunting and others, you can strike it with a projectile. Tayyib is interesting, you know, because it's really, in my opinion, it's ethics, and it's an ethical approach to the consumption of food. Now, what I think happens is that when I went back to write about this subject, is I thought it was going to be all within the literature of our text and we'd find it, but it wasn't. And what normally, traditionally, scholars dealt with tayyib to deal with purifying your wealth when purchasing your food. Because you know the hadith that says that the Prophet that was with the Sahaba, and they said that the Prophet mentioned a man that, right, thumma dhakar rajulan yatil safar, that he has been on a long journey, ash'atha aghbara, his hair is disheveled, he's covered in dust, yamuddu yaday ila sama, he raises his hands to the sky, ya rab, supplicating to his Lord. But Allah says that his food is haram, his drink is haram, his clothing is haram, and he is nourished by the haram. How can I answer his dua? So the early generations looked at this, that not from that he was consuming the haram, but the means of his wealth was impure, and he was therefore consuming a food that was considered haram because he had usurped the wealth, or he had taken it illegally, or whatever the means could have, you know, could have been. Now, for our time, when we talk about like the type of ethical treatment of animals, we talk about free range, we talk about pasture raised, those were all the default of the earlier generation. So they didn't need to speak about them because they were inherently implicit in the context in which they lived. But now today, we don't have that any longer. So we have to, in my opinion, understand tayyib as both of those things. Now, how the traditional scholars talked about it, but also return back to that ethic of a manner in which the Prophet ﷺ, you know, talked about treating animals, animal rights, or you know, don't slaughter these animals when they are healthy and ride them when they are healthy. He talked about, you know, an animal that would look sickly or other things like that. So again, that's how if we were to break it out now, is a summary. Halal is the legal. As we said, the bar is pretty low on that, right? In terms of how you make an animal halal, okay? There's only conditions that you have to talk about is that, you know, the religious status of the slaughterer, the tool which is used, and mentioning the basmala at the time of the slaughter. Once you fulfill those three, the animal is halal. So the bar is pretty low. It doesn't talk about how it lived before, you know what I mean? But now you have all the hadith where the Prophet is saying, you know, don't slaughter animals in front of other animals. Don't sharpen the knife in front of another animal. Do you want to kill it twice, he says. You know, all of these types of things. To me, that's the tayyib aspect of it, okay? And then the last part we talked about, what you said, the zabiha we talked about, is the actual act of slaughtering, which is to cut the two jugular veins and the trachea and the esophagus. So when someone says to me, "Oh, this meat is halal, but it's zabiha, but it's not halal," it can't be. It can't be.
Someone said that to you before?
All the time. I hear this. All the time I hear this.
I mean, technically, you could slaughter a pig. It wouldn't be halal, but it would be zabiha.
Yeah, you're right.
Linguistically, yeah.
No pork on my fork, though. That's right. I'm very curious then, given the context of the average Muslim in the West, we're consumers, we're going to restaurants, we're eating at home and buying from meat stores, or we're eating at other people's houses. Given this context, pretty much everything that is halal is going to be zabiha. Would you say those terms are equivalent in the context of what's available in the market without you actually going hunting yourself?
Yes, I would. Yes, I think, you know, because that would be major. You know what I mean? Like if people found out that you were selling meat that wasn't slaughtered and you were calling it halal, I mean, that would be, you know, aside from the whole like relationship that you have to deal with God on that one, like your business, you'd be out of business.
That, so there's, I guess, two situations that come up fairly often. And then these are the nitty gritty. And I feel like if we talk only about that, we'll be here all night because there's like a million different scenarios you could look into. But number one is you go to a restaurant and they say that everything is halal. For them, that means everything is not pork. And for you, that means everything is zabiha. There's a little disconnect here. I definitely have heard people say halal just means it's not categorically haram, like pig, like eating dogs.
No, but here we go though, right? Here we go. You have to make meat halal. Meat inherently by itself cannot be halal. It has to be made halal. You see what I mean? That's the legal position. And that's going across any of the schools.
I think nowadays, you know, like 30, 40 years ago, that issue happened a lot, I think. But I think nowadays everybody is aware that because the Muslim community has grown so much now, there's more halal options. Now everybody knows that if you use the term halal, that you automatically know that, okay, this means that it was slaughtered according to the Islamic principles and Muslims are allowed to eat it. But nowadays, the other thing that has popped up is the issue of machine slaughter versus hand slaughter. So that's another thing where people are now putting a new meaning onto the words halal and zabiha. They're saying halal is just regular halal with the machine, and zabiha is the actual halal with the hand cut meat. So that's the latest terminology now.
So basically, and that's an interesting point because it really comes down to, okay, so basically here's the thing. Remember I said that one of the conditions of slaughtering is the basmala? Like you have to say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, right? Now, if you forget it, right, if there's an unintentional forgetting of it, then it's like it's okay. But if you intentionally leave it out, then that meat is not permissible, okay? Now, the argument that's happening with machine slaughter is this. The person comes in, flicks the switch, Bismillah, and that's it. Okay? And that suffices now for all of the animals on that line that will be slaughtered. Or now again, now we're moving into like to like industrial meat production, right? So it's a whole nother like economics and other things such as this, of how we scale up. The second point is then, okay, there's an audio machine that's just saying, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. And as the animals move through the line, the Bismillah is being said. But what if the timing is off now, right? I get an animal, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, then it's cut. The third one is that you cannot guarantee that decapitation doesn't occur in the machine slaughter on each bird. Because that falls into a category which is called meita, carrion, which makes that meat haram. You can't eat it. Okay? So those are the areas in which people are arguing on the side that machine slaughter it doesn't fulfill the requirement of halal. Right? But then you have others that say, no, halas, we just flick the switch and say Bismillah, and we're good. And so that's the area that the argumentation is coming in now. And there are people that are arguing that it's permissible And so it moves forward with that, you know. And so yeah, it's a challenge for folks. You know, it's a challenge for folks.
The process of the animal, you know, going through that process and then cutting it open and then, you know, cutting it into pieces. In a Muslim slaughterhouse, this process can take anywhere between 20 and 25 minutes. In a non-Muslim slaughterhouse, they try to do this within 7 minutes. So the faster you move an animal through the, you know, through the line, the more money it is, the more animals. And I'm talking about cows, but, you know, the fat beef, the faster you move, the less the cost, et cetera, et cetera. So that's become an issue altogether. So I can tell you with, you know, a decent amount of conviction that, you know, that there is no God in that equation, as you mentioned. You have to understand that there was no machine slaughter up until recently.
Mm-hmm. There were no machines.
There were no machines. So all of a sudden now you have machine slaughter. And so hence the difference between and machine slaughter for the most part has to do with chicken. For the most part, you know, they're on a line, they move, it's quicker, it's easier, it's more efficient. And so, by the way, even hand slaughtered chicken go through a machine, for people that don't know. The only difference between hand slaughter versus non-hand slaughter is that in the hand slaughter process, there's actually a human being standing there, you know, saying Bismillah and, you know, slaughtering each or cutting each chicken or killing each chicken. And in the complete machine slaughter process, you know, when the person turns the machine on, the person will say Bismillah, and then it's just a knife, an automatic knife that's, you know, that's killing the chicken. So yes, is there a difference of opinion within the various different? It's not a difference of opinion within the schools of thought per se. It's a difference of opinion within the scholars, and they could fall within any different school of thought in regards to machine slaughter, chicken being halal or not. So even within the same, because it's a modern phenomenon. So even within the same school of thought, for example, you will have a difference of opinion whether machine slaughter is permissible or not. While I do believe that hand slaughtered chicken specifically is the way to go, to call machine slaughtered chicken absolute haram is, I think, slightly problematic.
So I'm sure you've probably run across this as well, where some people say, oh, this is zabiha halal. That means it's been hand slaughtered. And then they kind of imply that, you know, machine slaughtered is not acceptable. Do you have any opinion on that?
If they're saying that if the biha is going to refer to hand slaughtered and halal is going to refer to machine slaughtered as well, then that might imply that there's a problem with non-hand slaughtered meat. I don't know how the different schools of thought in the Sunni school of thought are in regards to this fiqhi matter. But from the Shi'i perspective, we have our maraji', the grand scholars that we follow. And so there might be some opinions here, some different opinions here. But all in all, I can say this, that the majority, I would say nowadays, they don't have an issue with machine slaughtered. And so I do remember, you know, after COVID happened, you know, of course, chicken prices and all that went up. And so there was this whole thing happening here in Texas in one of the restaurants where it just wasn't worth it for them anymore to bring in hand slaughtered meat. And so they were bringing in machine slaughtered meat. And so, or at least chicken, if I'm not mistaken. And so it's interesting how there was a whole debate on Facebook in regards to that particular restaurant and people, you know, there's Shias, Sunnis talking and stuff. And then the restaurant owner themselves had brought Ayatollah Sistani's fatwa on the matter and put it there as one of the authorities in this regard, although the restaurant is not owned by a Shi'i. But it was interesting how they had found that fatwa and inquiry from his office and they had put it there. So for those who follow his fatwa on this matter, which is a majority of the Shia, especially in the West, you know, this distinction of halal versus dhabiha, or in other words, let's say hand slaughtered versus machine slaughtered, this is something that is pointless. Yeah, practically, the it doesn't have any implications because machine slaughtered will also be halal. When we use, when we make names and we coin terms, it's going to confuse the masses. So I don't know why we're using these Arabic terms here. Maybe dhabiha, you know, because originally in back in 1400 years ago during the Prophet's time, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, they would slaughter by hand. And so now we're going to call that dhabiha, dhabah, you know, which is slaughtering. But come on, like today we're using machines too. That's not slaughtering. That's, what is that then? Just killing? What are you going to call it, you know? So the fact that we're going to use Arabic terms here is going to confuse a lot of people. Just say we have machines slaughtered.
And now a word from this episode's sponsor, Done School.
As a Muslim, I often can't find halal food to eat when I go out with my family. But at Done School, I get to eat 3 meals and snack on halal options all day. I really appreciate the halal food that I get to eat has such a variety. Like last week, I got to eat steak, chicken tikka masala, chicken parmesan, carne asada, and turkey bacon. They were all halal certified, carefully prepared, and straight up delicious. Mashallah, it's a real blessing to be able to fully take part in all my school meals.
Come see why whole student education is right for you. Visit dunschool.org.
Are there differences within schools of thought? And by school of thought, I mean madhab.
To begin with, maybe within the Sunni and Shi'i schools, or within the sort of, you know, the other, you know, subcategories of different schools within those thoughts, there may be certain differences. There's no humongous differences. As far as the rules of slaughtering meat or consuming halal foods, they're pretty much the same everywhere. There's really no differences per se within the schools of thought, in my opinion. Not in my opinion, but what I mean to say is there's really no differences within the schools of thought when it comes to the halalness, if we may, or the haramness of the food. If it's halal, it's halal within all the schools. If it's haram, it's haram in all the schools. I think what ends up happening is that there's a difference in understanding the concepts, right? So, for example, the concept of the meat of the people of the book, it was clearly understood that, you know, it was permissible. And while everyone opted for, primarily opted for that which was halal, and when I say halal, I do mean hand slaughtered, that's what they did. And in case if they didn't, then they would, they could opt for the meats of the people of the book. But otherwise, you know, this was always this understanding. Then, you know, now again, the food of the people of the book, yes, it is definitely permissible. The problem is not the permissibility. The problem is the way those meats are prepared. Okay. So if you were to take me to a kosher restaurant, right, and you were to tell me that, you know, this is the best pastrami you could find in New York, right, I'd be like, yes, let's do this. If you can tell me that it's kosher, absolutely. But then there's certain rules that the people of the book that have to follow in order for those meats to be permissible. The problem is for people who are deep into this industry within the United States specifically, and have been to, you know, the average Muslim has probably not even been to a single slaughterhouse. So while the average Muslim or a Muslim scholar will definitely tell you that the food of the people of the book is perfectly permissible, the problem is that the meat that is sitting in front of you in the supermarket probably doesn't follow any religious standard altogether. So that's when it becomes problematic for me to pick up a steak, for example, at Costco, or a steak at, you know, or chicken at a certain supermarket versus actually walking into a, you know, a kosher certified restaurant, if that makes sense.
Although I do want to say this, that there aren't huge differences when it comes to the halal, the dhabiha, and how it's a, and whether or not meat is halal to eat as a result of it being slaughtered properly. Because I will say this on the side, just in a quick parenthesis that I'll open up, is that I contacted Ayatollah Sistani's office once a few years ago, and I was like, look, if a Shia is getting meat from a Sunni, yes, because there are slight differences in some of these schools, and you know, they might not match the Shi'i school of thought in that regard, do they have to investigate further to make sure that it was slaughtered according to their school of thought? The answer was no. As long as the Sunni brother or sister says that this is halal. Now, this is back then when halal only meant one thing, by the way. All right? It's slaughtered properly. Let's just say that. It's slaughtered properly. As long as he says that, that's fine. You're good. Okay? So I do want to point this out. If there was a huge difference between the schools, then they wouldn't say you're good to go. All right? But all in all, there might be some slight differences. There will be different opinions on this matter as well. Yes, you will have, I don't know if we'll get to this later, but like when it comes to seafood, there will be differences of opinion between Shi'i scholars. Ayatollah Fadlullah will say that, you know, a lot of seafood is halal, but then Ayatollah Sistani will say, no, for me, it's like only two or three things that are halal, you know. Ayatollah Fadlullah might be closer to the Sunni school of thought when it comes to his fatwa on seafood. So like a person will ask, a Shia will ask, all right, well, why? Why such a difference of opinion? Well, this one considers this hadith reliable, this one doesn't, or this one has this understanding from this hadith, this one doesn't.
You know, when a scholar gives a fatwa, you know, you're technically supposed to only give a fatwa on something if you are involved or if you're in that society or in that situation, right? Because otherwise you don't know what's going on in your
local. It's recommended. It's not a condition, but it's kind of like best practices. Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? But here's the thing, what really caught me. So when you look at fiqh and it says that, so for example, there's a hukum which is called janaba, okay? So janaba is if an animal, we'll just say a chicken in this context, right? If an animal consumes najasa, okay? An animal consumes dung, we'll say. So najasa is haram for consumption, but an animal consumes it. Is that animal now permissible to slaughter? So the answer is yes, if three conditions don't change. And it's the same three conditions for water with regard to wudu, which is lawn, rih, wa ta'am. So color, smell, and taste. If those three conditions don't change inside the meat, then the meat is permissible for one to eat. And even if it does change, the scholars say it's only makruh tahrim, it's not haram, okay? Now, my question is, if you've never slaughtered before, what's your default then? You have no default to know that the taste, color, and smell has changed. So that's why it's imperative for us to be having an experiential, a practical application of the law with the, you know, textbook legal understandings as well too. They have to go hand in hand. So basically what I want to say is that, you know, when there is a difference of opinion and there's a valid like ijtihad that has occurred and you derive and you come at two different places, what that means, what I studied, and again, if someone has a different opinion, then please, you know, they should share that. But what that means is that one cannot bring condemnation on the other group because there is a valid position that has been taken, whether you, irrespective of you disagreeing with it, right? So for me to say that it's haram, right, and you shouldn't eat it, that's a tough place to argue, although I, you know, oppose that position. Now, application for oneself, that's something totally different, right? And I think that's a place right now you know, where people should be, moving towards. I do think that we lack education in these areas because they have been seen as periphery. Like those aren't really big issues for us right now. Well, no, they are big issues. And I'll tell you why. The hadith that I mentioned to you of that context of which, you know, Allah says, how can I answer your dua? That's pretty big, man. That's not a peripheral issue. And then there's a narration where a companion, and it's slipping, it's not Sa'd ibn Waqqas, but there's another companion named Sa'd radiallahu anhu who comes to the Prophet and he says, Ya Rasulullah, O Messenger of God, supplicate that Allah answers Sa'd's supplications. And the Prophet says, Ya Sa'd, make your food halal, a tayyib, and Allah will answer your supplications. So, I mean, that's huge. That's huge. He didn't say make your food halal. He said make your food tayyib. So if we're talking about ethics and we're moving beyond, and here's the thing that I've talked about, that we are a hyper-legalistic community, like, okay, we fulfilled the legal aspect of it, but we left the ethical aspect of it. That's not the messengership of the Prophet Islam. He brought law, and he also brought an ethical orientation for all of us to be moving towards. And I feel what happens is that we become kind of a sedentary, and we say, halas, it's halal, and then we move on.
So basically, just to sort of like summarize things in a short sort of condensed cohesive statement, it's complicated, right? It's not like a bit like what is halal is not as straightforward as black and white. It's not that there's just one factor that you look at. There's a lot to take into consideration. There's differences of opinion in different groups. You know, not all Muslims are going to have the same standards or priorities with halal. And to add on top of that, certification organizations are private businesses when ideally they should be institutions that are drawing their funds from Bayt al-Mal, the government treasury, so that they don't have any conflict of interest.
You know, Abbas, I would have to slightly disagree with you on that first statement. I would say that it is not complicated, but I think we've made it complicated. So I want people to understand this from when you think of this from a Sharia perspective, right? An Islamic law perspective, it's not complicated. But I think we've made it complicated. And we've made it complicated because we want everything to be so easy for us. Okay, we want everything to be so easy for us. Just ask yourselves a question. Do you really want this to go inside your body or not? It's as simple as that. And you have to answer this question not from just a health perspective, from a spiritual perspective, right? If this is going in, how does it positively or negatively affect me and my ibadah and my worship and my relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? That's the real question.
Yeah, I think there's that spiritual layer that so often we forget when we're stuck in the technicalities, is that ultimately there's halal and haram for a reason, and that reason is your own spiritual reality.
That's what it comes down to.
Alhamdulillah.
There was some stuff on social media this year I saw about some Muslims who are advocating for like a vegan Eid. This was on Eid al-Adha, right? And that, you know, it's bringing up the points that you just mentioned, is that, you know, in my opinion, it's taking it to an extreme, right? Like, yes, there definitely is some problems in the way that animals are treated, and we're supposed to, but we have rules for how to treat the animals properly and make sure they're taken care of before they're slaughtered. But that doesn't mean that we give up the sunnah, you know, which we're supposed to do as Muslims, just because it's like a fad right now to become a vegan or something like that. So yeah, you brought up a good point, is that, you know, Allah has allowed us to eat animals, and we should do it if we want to, but we shouldn't force like an extreme opinion of going against what the Quran and Sunnah is teaching us to do.
Yes, I agree. With all the respect that I have, I mean, nothing against veganism, but yeah, if that's the reason, then yeah, we have to revisit the reason for it, or else, yeah, there's nothing wrong. I mean, people say, is it haram to be vegan? No, it's not haram. It's an interesting thing to do, actually. It's maybe something to try every now and then as well. But this mindset, I'm talking about the mindset, and Brother Irfan, you also are saying the same thing. Like, this is the sunnah of the Prophet, man. We even have hadiths that kind of reproach those who will put aside eating meat for you know, a certain given amount of time, I think maybe 40 days or so, I think we have in our hadiths. So yeah, we have that as well. This is sunnah. And so we have to figure out who are we exactly following? That's all that matters right now, I think.
MashaAllah. This
discussion.
MashaAllah. That's profound. I'm really glad that we were able to discuss that. It adds some color to a very black and white conversation of like, let's take the big picture. Let's look at the spiritual reality of things. What is the philosophy here? Like what, like, let's not get lost in the weeds, right? There's a real reason why we eat halal.
That's right.
Why we don't eat haram. So I like to ask you, not only from your perspective as a scholar, but also just in general in your life, in your lifestyle, from the things that you've seen and experienced, what is the reasoning? What is the philosophy behind restricting your diet? You're essentially telling your body, no, you're not going to have that as much as you want it. So what is, why do it at all? You know, as much difficulty as it puts us in, why?
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful question. You know, I mean, I think this gets to the larger picture. Like, what do we live for? Are we bodies with this thing called a soul? Or are we souls inside of a body? Right? So if we are the first part, then halas, man. Just eat whatever we want, man. We're just a body and, you know, that soul thing is secondary. No, we're the opposite. We're a soul that's trapped inside of this body waiting to be released and meet our creator. And so if the creator has mandated these things for us, so let's just move there. Maharam Allah shaynahu, right? Like Allah hasn't made something haram except for that it is detrimental for you. And Allah hasn't made something halal except for that it is beneficial for you. And now you move into the attributes of God. If you believe that God is Hakim, the all-wise, then you believe that statement. If you believe that God is the all-knowing, right, the all-informed, and only wants good for his servants, then that's the advice that I'm going to follow. You know, now to the degree that I'm able to follow it, I'm cool with that, right? We're on a journey, and we're all going to engage it in a way that we're able to. But just to write it off, you know, that's something that we really have to give pause to. And now I think about that, and like you said, you know, so why do we do these things? So that would be my first point. The second point is to also learn self-restraint, right? Because this whole like I've used this term before, like we'll just take like fasting, for example, right? To me, fasting is proximity to God through subtraction.
Wow.
Right? Compared to proximity to God through addition, like I'm adding prayers into my life. Right? I'm adding, you know, zakat could be another one of proximity to God through subtraction, right? My wealth is being subtracted. Food and desires are being subtracted from my life, and that brings me nearer to God. And now if you go and you look at Imam Ghazali's text on disciplining the soul, breaking the two desires, right? The lust, the sexual, the carnal desires of the stomach, and of the genitalia, like this is what he's talking about. And he says, and then the Prophet says, control two things for me, that which is between your lips and that which is between your thighs, and I will guarantee for you paradise. So these are the things that we talk about. Now, the tongue was about kind of what we say, but also it can be taken and interpreted as what we're going to be eating as well too, if we really wanted to think about it in that way, looking for higher levels of understanding of than just kind of what's on the surface. Right? Because the Prophet has said that, or the scholars have said that, you know, when you look at the ocean, right, that the real jewels are at the bottom. So we want to dig down deep and extract those jewels, man. And this is also coming from someone, I just want to be very, you know, transparent and clear. This is coming from someone who drank alcohol and did other things for 26 years of their life before becoming Muslim. And I can tell you between night and day the difference between these, man. Okay, well, let's just say your body is a gift from Allah. Let's just take that. So how do you treat a gift, man? And how do you treat a gift as special as a human body and honor that before God? Like, that's the level that I take this to.
That's very, very moving now. I think I'm going to have to start exercising now after listening to your talk.
I'm with you. I got you.
I'm motivated, man. I'm motivated. Let's go.
I'm going to start hitting the gym again.
And that's the thing. Like, whatever you can do, and that's why I've really come to this point. Sheikh Hamza nailed it in my mind. He said, you know, I was thinking about this on an airplane. He said, you know, when the oxygen mask drops down, and they're like, place the oxygen mask on yourself first and then on your child afterwards. He's like, I never understood that until I connected it with the verse, قُوْ أَنفُسِكُمْ وَأَهْلِكُمْ نَارًا. Save yourselves and your family from the fire. So there's a hierarchy there. Because if I can't save myself, I can't save my child in that situation on the plane. So here's the thing. I can't try and stop the whole city of Berkeley or Alameda County, but you know what I can do? I can deal with my household, man. So that my children have the principles of no wasting food. My children have the principles, because that's another big thing we don't talk about, man, is how much food waste that we put inside of the ground that is causing this methane gas and heating up the world. So as Muslims, again, then, right? Allah does not love those who waste. Quran. So let's start with those types of principles right now within our homes, man. Ain't a luqma, not a morsel of food is going into the garbage, man. That's a principle that lives within inside of this household right now. Then we reduce, you know, the other types of things. And so you see what I mean? We build within our house. So when folks come to your house, like, man, that's how you get down. Yeah, that's how we get down. Wow, we need to make some changes in our lives. Okay, let us help you.
We are very grateful for the time that the scholars have shared with us in order to increase in our understanding of halal and our understanding of each other. Overall, the main takeaway that I got from these interviews is that different scholars have different interpretations and understandings of the requirements of halal, and that there's a level of tolerance needed from us, and that requires a deeper understanding. My main hope is that from these interviews we conducted, that members of the halal community will appreciate there are differences in understanding, and to not hold each other accountable to their own personal understanding. Overall, I hope we become more sensitive to these differences so that we can better find food that suits our understanding of halal without ever causing offense to others.
Stay tuned for our next episode where we go into some frequently asked questions, including those related to alcohol, kosher, seafood, and the etiquette around eating halal.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the Artistic Foodies. Before we go, show some love for your favorite podcast by leaving us a review on Google Podcasts.
Be sure to find us on Facebook and Instagram to stay tuned for more episodes as well as bonus content. You can have access to all of our episodes at our website, theartisticfoodies.com.
This podcast has been brought to you by Halal Fest Incorporated and Gathering All Muslim Artists.